Hello?
Can you hear me?
I was hoping Luther. Anybody know Luther? Okay, I hope. He was the guy that farmed for Green Giant for a while in his younger days. Well, I was hoping he's here. I had a talk with him a couple days ago, and it was interesting. And he was kind of agreeing with some of the things I was saying that, you know, he used to contract farm for Green Giant. He used to grow green beans. You know, at some point in his life, he did that, and he said, you know, that they told him, you know, when to plant, what to put on it, and he just basically followed orders. And that's the way a lot of our farming's done these days. You know, that we get in the store. These farmers, it's kind of a safety net for them. You know, they don't, you know, the contract's there. They get, you know, that's kind of they get paid And it takes some of the risks out of it. And a lot of farmers do that. And they get these good contracts, but they're really not free to do what they want or what they know might be right. And I've talked to enough, you know, enough seminars, you know, at Acres conferences and around where you get some of the big farmers. I've heard their complaints with that sort of system. You know, they've all partaken of it at some point, it seems like. And they're just not having any fun anymore, you know, following orders from people that kind of give the commands from boardrooms and stuff like that. So, and they complain a lot of times, and I was hoping Luther would back me up on this if he was here. A lot of times I've heard the complaint that, you know, the food that they grow out there in their fields, acres of, in this case, green beans, they don't bring it home to their table. They have another home plot where they don't put the stuff on that they put on the commercial plot that they're being told how to farm. They don't eat the green beans they ship off their hundreds of acres. They eat what they grow without all the chemicals on their home plot. So, and I didn't know if that was the experience of Luther, but I was going to ask him the question. And but you know, that's what's going on in farming today. There's something called contract farming, and you know, it's been criticized as to, because what you're having is you know, growing decisions made by people who their bottom line is you know, yield and profit, and that's it. It's not nutrition. It's not saving the, you know, doing the right thing by the environment. And as we heard, you know, we have to eat according to God's design. But let's go a little further and say that, you know, we're designed to eat certain foods, and we know that, you know, as our health message describes it. Plants are designed to eat certain way too. They're living things just like we are. And if it just seems to make sense, if it matters what we, how we eat, then it wouldn't have to matter how they eat. So we can't put on them something we wouldn't accept for ourselves. Does that make sense to everyone? That, you know, a plant is a living organism designed by God, and it has to be fed and nourished a certain way in order to be healthy, just like we do. And that was my point I was trying to make, and I'll move on. Okay, I've heard it more than once since I've been here. You know, I'm talking about all this, you know, knowing where your food comes from and buying local, and yet when I've been here, I've eaten popsicles and out of the ABC, and I had a Subway sandwich just a few minutes ago, and I didn't know where any of that came from. And it was good, though. It was vegetarian, you know. But still, I don't know how any of that was grown, and so, you know, I've been, you know, you got to walk your talk, right? So it's kind of hard where you're out of your element. I try to walk my talk at home. I know local farmers. I try to eat as much local produced food as I can. I go to the farmer's market, and I even buy food at two or three times more than the grocery store price and eat it, you know? And the thing is, if it's got more nutrition in it, you eat less of it. And you buy less of it, and it's not as expensive as you think. But anyways, I was driving over here, and I bought me some locally grown, wild-gathered ramps. And I have never seen a ramp in my life. And I don't know how to cook them or prepare them, but the guy was a local guy on the side of the road selling ramps. So I'm walking my talk here, and if anybody wants to, I don't have a stove, if anybody wants to prepare these for me, I'll be more than happy to share. I just want to taste, you know, just one helping, and you guys, and whoever fixes it can have the rest, okay? And therefore, I don't know if I got had, but I paid whatever he asked. I paid I think it was $2 a pound. I got 3 pounds here. Show me what these are. Wild crafted. He assured me that he got them out of the woods. There's been no sprays on them, and I said that's exactly what I'm looking for, you know. And I bought them. So supported the local economy, and kept that. I could have gone to Walmart, and I probably could have bought ramps for $1 a pound, but. Instead of that $6 I spent at Walmart, three of those dollars being shipped to Bentonville, Arkansas, and to stockholders all over the world outside of Elkins, that $6 stayed in Elkins and supported the local economy, and you recycled the dollars inside the community, and that's the way we build communities. Okay, we spend locally. We act locally. We build relationships while we're trying to help the community, and the community sees that. So, and with that, we do it with how we spend our food. And let's support the local farmer. And even, you know, if he doesn't grow organically, fine. But if he does, let's support him too. And we got to be pretty chummy for the 5 or 10 minutes we spent together. And I just took that picture like an hour ago. And that's Jesse Payne. So if you see him, tell him I said hello. And if I see him again, and I'll buy more ramps. And we can have a big dinner, okay? I'm sure he would be glad about that. And we built a little relationship in the 10 minutes we talked together. So, all right, let's start off with a little biblical quote here. And I don't know if you guys know this. Numbers 13:23, and they came into the brook of Eshcol and cut down thence a branch and with one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between the two upon a staff, and they brought the pomegranates and the figs. And I don't know about you, but I can bear a bunch of grapes between two fingers. And so I can't imagine what this land was that God was about to give them. But if you go a little further in the chapter, it says and showed them the fruit of the land. And these are the spies that went over. They showed the other people the fruit of the land, and they told him and said, "We came into the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it." And if that term floweth with milk and honey. I mean, I guess if you're a vegan vegetarian, you might say, "Is the Bible saying it's okay to drink milk?" You know, but really, that's what they call an idiom, or a Hebrewism, or a figure of speech, and it just means we all heard this in our fifth grade history class, the Fertile Crescent. It just means the land was fertile, because it's not talking about literal milk and honey. It's talking about, we just read it, it's talking about grapes and figs and pomegranates, okay? And they're huge. The question then becomes, it says, before we exert our dominion over our gardens, ask, you know, is this, the thing that made them big and the thing that made it fertile was all, they didn't have all the pesticides and herbicides and chemical fertilizers we have. The thing that made it fertile was all the biological life that was assisting those plants grow. And that's what we're trying to get back to here, was we're trying to get back to a biological form of farming where we, instead of trying to do an end around or, you know, totally annihilate the biology in the soil in order to grow a crop, we work with nature rather than annihilate nature and take its place. And before we exert our dominion, let's ask, is whatever I'm doing, whether I'm tilling or whether I'm fertilizing or whatever I'm doing in my garden, am I helping my soil, my biology above ground and below, or am I hurting it? And you might want to stop and think before you hurt your biological life above and below ground. And maybe there's something else you can do. That's the whole point. I remember right after that church farm I was at the first year, we done a lot of work. It was kind of into summer. And we were sitting there, me and I forget who it was, but we were sitting there, and we were kind of just having a nice talk. You know, it was kind of late in the evening. It was cooled down. And we looked and we noticed right around sunset, you know, in that kind of, what do you want to call it, that sort of enchanting hour of right between dark and day, Yeah, twilight. But what's a better word for enchanting? I don't want to, you know, get any Harry Potter stuff or anything. But, you know, just this really blessed hour, you know, sort of between the day and the night. And looked up and noticed that just above the garden, really nowhere else, just above the garden, there was just like a gazillion dragonflies. And I think dragonflies like water, don't they? You know, you see them around water. Well, there's no water around. There was just dragonflies. You know, that's the thing you kind of got to look at, and you kind of got to go say, why all these dragonflies? So I, you know, hurried home, and it was really neat to watch them because, you know, they do all their acrobatics. And they, as I was reading about dragonflies, I realized that they were eating, they eat insects. And that's how they can do all the acrobatics. And they eat insects on the fly. And they can, you know, go after them and dive bomb them and eat them on the fly. And that's why they have all the, acrobatics. And that was just a good sign that whatever we were doing over that garden plot was working, you know, because it wasn't chasing away biology, it was bringing biology. And you know, usually around twilight, the mosquitoes are pretty bad, but we weren't getting bitten by mosquitoes at all. And these dragonflies were there eating the mosquitoes, the things that suck blood. This is what we want to try to, you know, observe these little magic moments, or not magic, you know, observe these little wow little moments in nature. And realize we have to promote this. We have to farm this way so we can promote all life, not just us, but all life. And I think God will bless us in that. All right, we left off yesterday. I felt like I left you in a lurch on the amendments. I had other things I wanted to say. I passed out some sheets here, and I didn't really get to explain them. I wanted to pick back up on this. Amendments. You know, you're going to have to improve your soil. You can't just expect to go out there, till it up, and plant stuff and expect it to grow. Because most soils, like Bob Gregory says, and I heard him say this, is all soils are bad. Pretty much he's right. You know, there's something we're going to have to do to all soils to get it to come in line. And we're going to have to balance the nutrients. I already went over about foliars. Fertigation can be used instead of soil drenches. Anybody know what fertigation is? Okay, fertigation is a combination word. It's a cross between irrigation and fertilizing. So you call it fertigation. So what you do is that Berry Hill irrigation, you can take, and they have tanks and different ways you can take and inject, like fish emulsion, which is biologically friendly, into the water as you water through a drip line. That's called fertigation. Or you could overhead it if you want. You know, you just pump it in your irrigation water and you fertilize while you irrigate. Accomplish two things with one stone. We can talk about that after this. Soil energy should be maintained. I brought it in. There's this thing called ERDS. And all your chemical fertilizer companies know about the energy in soil. Plants live off energy. They don't just suck up nitrogen, you know, or they just suck up calcium. They live off the... Carrie Reams talked about the ion exchange between chemicals. And as you put stuff on, as we eat stuff, it's the same principle. You know, we take molecules apart, and then your body recombines them. And it's this movement of ions, you know, as you break apart compounds and re-put compounds together, it's this movement of ions that creates energy. And that's what we live off of, because when we digest food, and that's what the plants live off of. So there's a way you can measure how much, you know, of this action, this ionization action is going on in your soil. You can buy one of these. It's called a conductivity meter. And all it is two probes. And you take about a half, this is my garden soil, you take about a half a jar of garden soil, and you take about a half a jar of distilled water. And I was going to do this, but I don't have time. You put it in here, you stir it up. You know why we use distilled water when we do this, right? There's no current that can pass through distilled water. It's a complete zero, okay? So now any current you get that registers on here will be just what's caused by the energy in this soil, the ionization potential of the soil. And so you put this probe in, and you can measure how many microsiemens of resistance exists between the two probes. And what you want is, and this is a cheap little tool, it's like $75, $80, and what you want is, and the chemical guys do this, and they're able to do it with their high-soluble fertilizers, but they destroy life. We want to try to maintain a high-energy soil without destroying life, and what you do is, you want to keep this reading above 200 microsiemens, below 1,200 microsiemens. You ever heard of something burning because it's too hot? The fertilizer's too hot? Well, it's because it's above 12. The energy in that soil is above 1,200 microsiemens. But if you ever just looked out at your garden and it just seems to be sitting there for a couple of weeks not doing anything, well, that's because there's not a lot of ionization going on there, and you need to do something that will pick that up. okay? And usually, you know, you can check this once a week, and another time it gets really, really low when you go start dropping below 200 is when, like after a rain. Everybody's seen how a rain kind of makes things pop, right? You know why that is? Why things kind of just seem to grow about an inch after a good rain and look so healthy? That's because the nitrogen raindrop is bringing nitrogen down from the air, which is 80% nitrogen, and it's dissolving into the soil just a little bit enough to give that an easy nitrogen rush and make everything pop a little bit. And that's great. But what happens is if you get a high volume of rain in a short amount of time, that's why we like slow misting rains, not torrential downpours, is you flush out a lot of your soluble nutrients. Even if you're organically farming or biologically friendly farming, you'll flush out a lot of your soluble nutrients, and then after you get the initial little pop, you'll get a week of lag, because really the water has just taken all your solubility away, right? And what I find is I'm having to do soil drenches about 2 or 3 days after, you know, a big rain. And that sort of bridges that gap until the biology can bring some solubility back into my soil and bring those herbs back up naturally. But the soil drench, I find, helps me sort of bridge that gap and keep those crops going. So this is a handy little tool along with the refractometer. And you can, I don't know if I have it on here, but you can use the refractometer to monitor your leaf sap while you're growing. And I'm going to talk about that with insects. You don't just monitor the sugar content of a finished fruit. You can monitor the sugar content of the leaf while you're growing, and then if it drops below a certain level, you can take some, you know, remedial actions. And that gets into some insect control. Okay, water used in foliars and fertigation is best distilled. Well, it's hard to irrigate with distilled water, but you can take, if you've got a small garden, I do, you can take, and anytime you use a foliar, you know, that's that leaf spray I was talking about under the leaf in the morning. Anytime you use a foliar, you want to use distilled water. And get a gallon of distilled water, use it, because if you use hard water, there's just too much other things in hard water, and whatever you put in there gets kind of lost or doesn't have the same as much punch. So you get a lot more punch for your foliar spray if you use distilled water. Does that make sense? Yeah, hope so. I talked briefly about cation exchange capacity. And for now, just remember that if you have something like 10 or less in your cation exchange capacity number, the guy who does this is the Albrecht guys. They use the cation exchange capacity, and I'm going to talk about that. But sand usually has a low cation exchange capacity, and clays usually have a high cation exchange capacity. Now, the beauty of sands is they drain very well, they warm up very well, and they have some benefits. But the thing is, because of the low cation exchange capacity, you can't just dump a lot of fertilizer on them. You got to put a little bit at a time on them, because it's like a small bucket. It's like taking a quart jar and trying to pour a gallon, and you fertilizing it and pouring a gallon of water in the quart jar. A lot of it just goes away. You wasted your money on sand soils, right? You have to shrink back how much you apply, but just apply smaller amounts in more frequent time periods. With clays, it's like having a gallon bucket, and you can pour in a gallon and it'll hold it, okay, when you fertilize it. So that's just the difference. That's just the Albrecht CEC, and it's worth kind of bearing in mind as you start to amend your soils, that low CEC soils can't hold as much as high CEC soils. Cation exchange capacity. Okay, organic amendments. I think I did a little bit of this yesterday, but when I wanted to go to this number one here. When you use compost, we talked about aerated compost teas, but when you use compost, a lot of what's being sold as compost in the stores, you know, the typical big box stores is... it's just ground up tree bark. You know, it's mechanically ground up tree bark, and it looks like, to you, the untrained eye, it looks like, oh, this is really, you know, it looks like organic stuff, and they say it's compost, so it must be. Be careful, because ground up tree bark is not compost. Compost has gone through a biological breakdown, not a mechanical breakdown. Okay, you want something that's rich and dark and crumbly, not just some ground up living matter. That doesn't constitute good compost. That's just ground up living matter. Okay, you want something that's been biologically broken down. So be on the lookout for that. And you can kind of tell. Also, be careful
I was talking to your local state extension agent on the phone this morning, and he agreed with me that that you know he's conventionally trained, but he's very open to organic methods. And he said he agreed with me. You can put on too much compost and manure. He says manures a lot of times drive up your phosphorus levels. And you don't want to drive up your phosphorus levels too high because you cannot get rid of phosphorus once it's too high, or it's very difficult to get rid of. Okay, it's kind of an I don't understand why it should. It's a like a triple negative anion. It's not a cation. So a lot of times anions are the ones that flush out, but for some reason phosphorus doesn't flush out. So manures will drive up your phosphorus numbers. They also can, depending on what they fed the animal. They can also drive up your sodium levels, and you don't want that either. You need some sodium, but you definitely don't need a lot. Compost can drive up your potassium levels, which is what happened with me. I'm going to get to it here. Compost, I put on a lot of compost, and I drove my potassium levels way up, too high, and then you're going to get weed problems. And none of those two things really help your calcium levels unless it's maybe caged chicken manure. Depending on the source, sodium can get high. Compost and manure does not address calcium. There's not a lot of calcium in compost and manure. It doesn't address nitrogen very well. I mean, maybe some manures do, but not a lot. It doesn't address sulfur very well or magnesium. It does provide, like I said, potassium, because it stimulates the biological activity enough where it will release a lot of potassium. It can be good if you need potassium, but not good if you don't. And it also gives you carbon, which is very good too for the soil. Carbon, you know, like I said yesterday, carbon can hold a lot more minerals than a clay particle. And carbon can hold, 1 pound of carbon can hold 4 pounds of water and release it when the plant needs it. So carbon's a good thing too. But not having the other things, you're not going to remedy your soil just with compost and manure. I guess that's my point. Okay, the three numbers on the bag, printed on every fertilizer bag, are NPK. And I think I talked a little bit about how the N was a true expression of elemental N, you know, single atom of N. But the P is not. It's not an elemental expression. It's a compound expression. This is a compound. You know the difference between a compound and a molecule, right? What is it? A molecule can be a molecule. A compound is always a molecule, but a molecule is not always a compound. N2 is a molecule, but it's not a compound because it's got just two N's. You have to have two different things to be a compound. So this is a compound because it's phosphorus and oxygen. And really, most of that compound is 56% oxygen, and only 44% is elemental phosphorus. So make sure, whatever your recommendation you get, are they talking elemental phosphorus? Are they talking about phosphorus pentoxide, I think it's called. Are they talking about this compound? And, you know, make sure you fertilize knowing that difference, because that'll make a huge difference on how much you apply. So make whatever recommendation you get from wherever you get it, make sure they say, oh, you need so many pounds of phosphorus per acre. Make sure they're talking and you're hearing the same thing. Elemental or this P205, and this is the compound plants use. I mean, they take this up, so it's okay. But you know, in order to apply the right amount, you got to know if they're talking elemental or the compound. And then when it gets over here to K, it's the same thing, except you get a little bit more K2O, which is potassium oxide, I believe, called potassium oxide. It's 83% elemental potassium, but the thing is, they don't have to register this on the back of the bag. Most of this potassium oxide is derived from potassium chloride. Okay, and if you read the fine print, it sometimes tells you, you know, this was derived from potassium chloride, and it'll also tell you, and there's 14% chloride in this bag as well as the. Well, that's more than any of these numbers. 14% chloride. Do you really want to put that on your soils? Because chloride, I mean, you need a little bit. But too much chloride kills biological activity. So, you know, just same as with our health message, you know, the first thing you do is stop doing what's bad. And then you start looking for ways to bring it back. But if you're gonna succeed, stop putting on anything where the potassium is derived from potassium chloride. Just find out other forms of, if you need potassium, other ways to get potassium in your soil. Do not use chemical, you know, these fertilizers that derive their potassium oxide from potassium chloride, because too much chloride comes with it. All right, just stop doing that, and you'll start improving your results right away just doing that. So really, this bag, instead of 10, 10, 10, if we elementally, is 10, 4.4, 8.3. Isn't that interesting? I mean, I thought that was neat when I learned that. Okay, now I gave you some formulas yesterday, and some people don't like math, but you're going to have to, you're going to have to do a little bit of it if you're going to apply the right amount of stuff. And it's not that hard. It's just a word problem, and it's a multiplication of fractions and, a little division, and you'll be okay. And I really remember when I was in grade school and we were talking about how to do word problems and multiply them. You always put in, if you remember to always put in your units beside every number, you'll never go wrong. You'll never get confused. So always, don't just write 300. 300 what? Because you get a string of numbers going, and you're going to forget what unit it is, and you're likely to mess up. And at the end of the equation, everything you don't want to really know should cancel out. You should have this K here cancels out with this K down there. This square foot here cancels out with this square foot here. So everybody know how to do that? See, this is great stuff for, you homeschoolers. You got math problems right here in your garden, okay? But anyways, let's take this word problem. I have a 400-square-foot plot, which is a nice little backyard garden, and I decide I want to use the fertilizer of potassium sulfate, which is 0051, and it's an organic potassium. It doesn't have any chloride in it. And I ignore the fact that if I go on the internet and I look up potassium sulfate, it's K2SO4, which is 45% calcium. You want to go with what's on the bag, 51% potassium, right? But we know that that number is not pure potassium, it's potassium oxide, the K2O. So the compound K2O is not straight K. I know K2O is 83% potassium elementally. So how much 0051, and it's got sulfur in it, it's potassium sulfate, so that's 18 sulfur, fertilizer do I use to put on my plot to equal 300 pounds of elemental potassium per acre? Do you understand the problem? We want elemental potassium, 300 pounds, but we're putting on a compound, and we're not putting it on an acre, we're putting it on 400 square feet, so we got to figure that number out. What is it on my 400 square feet? And so this is how you do it. You just put 300 pounds of potassium over, because you're applying that to a whole acre. Remember, it was 300 pounds per acre. But yours is only 400 square feet, so you can cross that out, and you've adjusted for your smaller size, not a whole acre. You come over here, and you know that if it's 51% potassium oxide, that 100 bags of potassium, 100 bags of this fertilizer, potassium sulfate, will give you 51 pounds of potassium oxide. But we know that it's only 83%, so we have to adjust for that to get our elemental K, which is what we want, elemental K. So we do 100 pounds of K2O would equal 83 pounds of elemental potassium. And then you get this number, you divide it into each other, and you get, on my 400 square foot plot, I need to get 300 pounds an acre, I need to apply 6.5 pounds of potassium sulfate, 0051. Did that put everybody to sleep? It's not hard. And plus, you picked up a sheet here yesterday that basically does all that. And I gave you the plug and chug formulas right up top. It's just simple fraction multiplication. It's not hard. You learned it in grade school. You did it. You can do it again. All right. Okay, now here's the thing. The thing on the bottom of the bottom of the thing here is a website. Because you say, well, Scott, how did you know that there was in K2O, the K2O had, this is right on the bag, the 51%, but that's potassium sulfate. How did you know that K2O is only 83% elemental potassium? And the answer is, you go on this website, they're called, Gordon, what are they called? Molar weights? Molar. Yeah, you're looking up the molar weight, and you can punch in, they'll give you a little window, and you can punch in K2O, and you don't have to worry about subscripts in it. You can just put a 2 right beside it. It'll figure it out. And you put in K2O, and it'll shoot you out the percentages down there of how much of that compound is potassium and how much of that compound is oxygen. And that's how I got the 83%. Okay? Is everybody with me? Or okay. Anyways. Now, let's go to another word problem. There's only three. This is the second one, and it gets easier every time. That was the hardest one, okay? Now, your recommendation says you need to put on 300 pounds of potassium oxide. So, again, you're going to use potassium sulfate to get potassium oxide, but this time you don't have to worry about the 83%. You can just put on straight potassium oxide, and you know that 51%, 51% is what is potassium oxide. So now you just get to drop one expression off the formula. And now you only have to do three steps. You adjust it for your square footage per acre. And you know, that's what you got to understand. Most of your recommendations were going to be recommended to you in pounds per acre, especially on the macronutrients. What are the six macronutrients? Somebody? Huh? Phosphorus? Huh? What'd you say? No. It's macro, but I mean, it's nitrogen, phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, calcium, magnesium, one more. Huh? There you go, sulfur. That's the six. Okay, everybody get that. That's your macronutrients. Before you do anything else, cover crops are first, and then if you want to spend some more money, spend it on balancing your macronutrients. And there's six of them, those six. Okay? So, I don't know why I jumped into that. But anyways, we know that this is a simple formula because our recommendation was not for elemental potassium, but for potassium oxide, which is in every bag that has a 50, you know, the last number is whatever it is. Okay, let's go again. Now, here's another one, but this even gets easier because your recommendation says, we want you to apply 300 pounds of potassium sulfate an acre. Well, now, all you got to solve for is your square footage reduction. You don't have an acre, you reduce it down to 400 square feet, and you got a very much simpler formula. You just dropped another expression off the formula, and you put on 2.75 pounds of potassium sulfate to equal 300 pounds per acre of potassium sulfate. Easy, right? Just got easier. So all I'm saying is, I'm going through this so you'll when you get a recommendation, make sure you talk with whoever's giving you the recommendation to say, are you talking elemental? Are you talking in the compound it normally comes in? Are you talking the mixture in the bag, the total mixture in the bag? Just, you know, ask them that, okay? And then do your formulas accordingly. Let's skip this one. All right, here's what I gave to you yesterday. And I don't know if you guys took it home and looked at it. Did anybody bring it back? You got this sheet? You know, you got it? Well, I hope you looked at it and you understood. I gave somebody this. They wanted to know, you know, it was an Adventist couple, and they wanted to know, you know, we want to know what you put on. We want to understand this. So I wrote it out for them. And, you know, they didn't want to do a soil test. They just wanted me to do the best guess test. And so I tried to put on things that weren't too much, and I put on, you know, I said, well, you're probably low in calcium, most soils are, and I said, why don't you try putting on 500 pounds of calcium an acre? Now, you could use that same formula. I don't know what the soils are like around here, but you should get it checked first, but, you know, 500 pounds, you know, most soils need like 3,000 pounds of available calcium to grow a good crop. So 500 pounds isn't going to get you in trouble overshooting it, unless you're already high, then it will, but we're just going to play the averages and hope you're not really high already, okay? Because that's what I mean. You need a soil test. But anyways, all I did was take that. All right. Here it is. That's the same formula up there. I had some calcium carbonate, that Ca calcium carbonate, CaCO2, and I know from the molecular website that formula expression or that compound is actually 40% elemental calcium. I would need 500 pounds of calcium per square foot. I did that whole formula right up there. And then I have a digital scale, and I measured, I measured one cup of this calcium carbonate weighed 0.8 pounds, 0.80. So really I did the math, and that came out to putting in 2.5 cups on her 70 square foot bed. Very doable. You got the sheet. Just plug it. If you can pick, and notice I got calcium. I got all six. You know, I got calcium. I got three forms of nitrogen. This is blood meal. This is ammonium sulfate. This is feather meal. This is gypsum, which is calcium sulfate. So I got calcium and sulfur in that one right over there. 19% sulfur, 23% calcium. I got phosphorus. I get some phosphorus in my soft rock phosphate. Plus I got some phosphorus that I put in the compost. I kind of guessed that one. It was about that phosphorus was about 6% in compost and about 8% in 8% potassium. And I got some potassium. I got magnesium. Now, most soils need boron. Now, where did I get the boron? Where could we get boron? You really don't have to go very far to get boron, huh? Borax. That's it. Borax is actually 11% elemental boron. Huh? Yeah. You use it in the laundry stuff. It comes from like Death Valley out in California, I think, or used to. Yeah, Walmart. It comes from Walmart. But anyway, that's an easy. And most soils, boron flushes out really, really fast. So most soils need boron every year. Okay? But you got to be careful. Too much boron is toxic to plants. So just be careful with boron. But you're usually going to need some every year. You're going to need sulfur every year because that flushes out. You're going to need some kind of nitrate nitrogen every year because that flushes out. Usually, I'm going to context that, usually. But those three things are very leachable, and usually every soil needs those every year. And hopefully we can get some of our nitrogen from our cover crop and not have to put so much anything else on like any of these other nitrogens. But see, I like to get my nitrogens from a lot of sources. Blood meal is 12% nitrogen. Now, some people, you know, the reason I use blood meal, and I've been contemplating not use it because of mad cow and all that, but the reason I use blood meal is because it's organic, it doesn't hurt the biological life, and it takes about a month and it's available, so it's relatively quick. So I got a quick acting, organically biofriendly nitrogen there in blood meal. I got a sort of a midway acting non-organic nitrogen and ammonium sulfate, but you're getting sulfur with an ammonium form of nitrogen. And if you remember, ammonium forms of nitrogen are higher up the breakdown chain than nitrate nitrogens. Okay, so if you put ammonium nitrogen on, it lasts a little longer than putting nitrate nitrogens on. Plus, it helps with the fruit production or reproductive stage of the plant. And then I put on feather meal, which is organic nitrogen, but it's a protein. It's just ground up feathers, and it takes longer to break down. It's like 3 or 4 months before that comes into play. So I got something that's ready in a month. I got something that's ready in a couple months, and I got a nitrogen ready, you know, in 3 months. See how I did that? And you can do that with a lot of them. I just happen to do it here with nitrogen. Anyway. All right, remember I was telling you yesterday about the as a farmer, you need to know that there's two cycles you really got to be concerned with, the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle. And forget what I was going to say. These two elements cycle from solids to soils to gases in the atmosphere and back. Okay, and we're trying to keep the nitrogen in longer, and we're trying to keep the carbon in longer. Okay, and this is kind of you can go online and look at these and see how all this takes place, and you want to slow it down in the soil, both of these. You want to slow it down in the soil, but what you do, like the way you till and how you fertilize. If you throw a bunch of chemical fertilizer, nitrogen on, you're going to burn out your carbon, and that's what we've been doing. They say actually, if we went back to a more organic type of farming where we quit using all the chemical nitrogens, we could reduce the greenhouse effect by 25%. That would, you know, most people think it just comes from cars, or if you believe it at all, I don't know. Some people don't believe we're having a climate change, but If you believe it at all, I think we are. I mean, seems that way. Just the USDA just changed the zone chart. You know, all across the nation. I was in 7B. It's how cold it gets in the winter. Kind of made for perennials. But it's a zone chart, and they've just changed it, and everything moved up. You know, a lot of people moved up a grade. I went from 7 almost 6 to 7 almost 8. I'm still in 7, but I'm on the other side of 7 now. So my area got, everybody's area got warmer. Okay, and that was the USDA. Just put that out in February or something like that. So things are getting warmer. So they say, if we changed the way we farmed and started capturing more carbon into the soil instead of burning it out and letting it go back up into the atmosphere, we could change the greenhouse effect by 25%. And that's a lot. Okay, this is just some scattered slides thrown in here. Carbon, when we're talking about capturing carbon, remember now carbon can come in three forms. You get green carbon is really a lot of nitrogen with it, and really we sort of refer to it as nitrogen, but it does have some carbon. It's low in carbon but high in nitrogen, but you could look at it as a form of carbon. But it's like those, like tilling in your fresh green cover crop, right? It primarily feeds the bacteria, and it has a rapid nutrient release. So really, you can plant in 2 to 4 weeks. Sources are pig and chicken manure without the bedding. The bedding is woody sawdust that drives up your potassium. Young plant material like fresh tilled in cover crop, and you can even put sugar on there. Brown carbon is like older, woodier plants, your wood chips and sawdust and stuff like that. They're not really decayed that much yet. Compost would be brown carbon, I would think. Old corn stalks, the things that have dried up. People talk about filling in dead leaves. That would be a brown carbon. It's high in carbon to nitrogen ratio, low in nitrogen, breaks down more quickly when you add nitrogen to it. So if I was tilling in a bed of leaves for the carbon and I wanted it to break, shallowly, I would go ahead and put some, it's carbon. The microbes need nitrogen to go with that carbon. So I would put on like a fish emulsion with high, like a 5-1-1 fish emulsion or something like that that had a lot of nitrogen on top, and it would break down more quickly because the microbes want both. They want carbon and nitrogen. So when you put a lot of carbon in there, you want it to break down quickly? Put some nitrogen on. If you till in green stuff that has a lot of nitrogen, put some sugar water on it, or put some kind of carbon on it, and it'll break down more quickly because that's what microbes do. They want carbon and nitrogen, and the nitrogen they use for their protein to build their tissues, and the carbon they use for fuel. And then you have things like black carbon, like activated charcoal. Most people don't put activated charcoal in their garbage; it's too expensive. But everybody heard of biochar. That's kind of got a lot of biochar. Anybody ever heard of that, biochar? Well, anyways, it's like charcoal. It's like big chunks of charcoal, and a lot of people are claiming the benefits of that. They say it's got a lot of potential. I'm not that up on it yet, but I'm looking into that. Biochar and stuff like that. But that's a black carbon, like a coal or something like that. Okay, there's five kinds of nitrogen. Organic nitrogen, not available, like the feather meal, the proteins. Okay, then there's things that the plant doesn't pick up protein. But when you have the biology in there and it breaks down, the first thing it turns into is ammonia nitrogen, which is NH4+. That plus means it's missing an electron in the outer shell, so it's a positive ion, and usually the positive ones link, they stay in your soil a little longer, and the ammonia nitrogen is good for fruit set. It's also a dominant in fungal-dominated soils, and we know fungal-dominated soils are woody things that grow woody plants, like blueberries or some of your perennials that you grow. And then the next stage of breakdown is nitrite nitrogen, which is NO2 with a little negative sign. It has turned into an anion now. It doesn't stay in the soil very well. And the next nitrate nitrogen, the next is nitrate nitrogen, which the plants do use. So they only use these two yellow ones. They don't use organic nitrogen or this middle nitrite nitrogen. And then the last step is either it leaches out of your soil as a nitrate nitrogen into the watershed, or it gets volatilized back up in the air as a nitrogen gas, which is N2. And we want to try to hold it in these three stages here because we use this stage and this stage. And this stage is in between. We want to kind of hold it in there as long as we can. Just sort of a point of interest, some common household forms of fertilizer. And I've used some of these. Milk, powdered milk, is a good form of calcium. And you can use it on your soils and in your plants for calcium sometimes. You don't know what the percentage is, but a little bit on a foliar probably couldn't hurt. Coca-Cola, we all know, has phosphoric acid in it. Probably not good to drink, but your plants kind of actually like the carbon and they like the phosphorus. Ammonia, you know, as long as it's not all the fruity ammonias that, you know, that smell nice or, you know, have all the sudsing materials in there. If you can get some good, clear, basic ammonia, you can use that as an ammonia nitrogen. And you can, like I said, you can put it diluted in water and spray it under your leaves and sort of spur a fruit set. Sugar is carbon. We all know that. And then vinegar is sometimes that's a nice acid to put in foliar sprays, a little bit, not too much. Because it seems to, sort of make the foliar sprays perform a little better in your wet applications. Okay, there it is there. So these are household items you can use. And also when I do a foliar spray, I put like a drop of dishwashing liquid. And it's the one with its non-antibacterial. Remember I was telling you about the triclosan and the antibacterial stuff? And that kills microbes and it does some other things too. But I use a non-antibacterial dishwashing soap and I put a drop in there because it's a surfactant and it'll actually help your foliar kind of stick to the underside of the leaf. Okay? We already named the big six. I think what I wanted, and that page was over there on the table. I think what I wanted you to get out of this slide is, here's calcium. It's a double cation, and you need about 3,000, depending on who you use. If you use Albrecht, this is important. If you use Reams, guys, this is important. And then here is what you can use is, okay, what do I have dry that I can balance my soils? You can put in what you have here. And do I have any wet or dry, really soluble stuff I can put on my foliar sprays or soil drenches here? So you can add what you want to find a good calcium source. You want to find a good phosphorus source. You want to find a good potassium source. You want to find both nitrogen sources, ammonia and nitrate. You want to find a good magnesium source, which is Epsom salt's a good one, and you want to find a good sulfur. The sulfur, remember, you don't want to put in pure sulfur. It's too acid, it kills microbes. You always want to look around, and if you need like manganese, use manganese sulfate. If you want to use iron, if you need iron, use iron sulfate. Always try to get your 40 pounds of available sulfur in a compound with something else you need. You understand that? Okay. So that's how you get your sulfur. Never put on pure elemental sulfur. It'll destroy your biological life. But here's what I wanted you to take away from that is, 3,000 pounds of available calcium. Now, if you're like only got 200 pounds in your soil test, you can't go from 200 to 3,000 in 1 year or one application. Okay, you got to build up gradually. You'll nuke your soils if you go, try to put on, 2,700 pounds of even good calcium, So, and here, phosphorus, if you're growing fruits, they say you need a 2-to-1 ratio of phosphorus to potassium, so you need on the high end of this. If you're growing leaves like collards or something like that, you're probably better off with a 1-to-1 ratio. So you 170 pounds if you're growing leaves, and if you're growing fruits, 340 pounds, so you got a 2-to-1 ratio. Potassium, you want about 170 pounds of available potassium. And remember, easy on the compost because that drives up potassium, and easy on the manure because that drives up phosphorus. Let me get up to that other line here in a minute. But 40 pounds of ammonia nitrogen, 40 pounds of nitrate nitrogen, 430 pounds of magnesium, and 40 pounds of sulfur. So you can kind of work the ratios out from there. Now, if you're an Albrecht fan, Albrecht is really, he's concerned about this, but he's really concerned about the percentages of cations stuck on a colloid of clay. Okay, and that's called the cation exchange capacity, CEC. And if you get it tested by one of these Albrecht guys, they're going to give you a CEC number, and their recommendations, they really want to see 70%. Let me go to that slide. Do I have that slide? No. Well, I think I have it in the next one. But really, I'll get to it in the next one. They want to see, around that clay colloid, they want to see 70% calcium. They want to see about 4% potassium, 3% of nitrogens, and 10% magnesium. And they say if you can get this your colloids with this percentage attached to it in the right amounts, that you will have perfect growth and perfect soil. That's what they promise. And I know people that use them, and they really like them. They say they get results. So, again, here are the highly leachable elements, nitrogen in the nitrate form, sulfur, boron, and also these are anions, molybdenum, potassium, and sodium. Okay, how do we keep those things from leaching off? We grow cover crops that spur our biological activity, and these things will get trapped in the crop and in the biology that the crop attracts. Okay, that's how we hold on to these things. But you're probably going to have to add some. Okay, three tools in our toolbox. You know, I was trying to do an analogy, but what's a health analogy with tools in a toolbox? I mean, you know, you do your diagnostic test. Well, any farmer can go and grab one of these for $75. This is a conductivity meter. Okay. Soil drenches, that's how you tell. How do I know if I need a soil drench? You buy a conductivity meter, or you just do a soil drench every month if you just want to go buy, you know, or do it after every big rain, like I was telling you. So, but if you want to be accurate, you measure it, because you can't manage what you don't measure. You buy one of these conductivity meters, and as the crop is growing, you can put on soil drenches and get the energy up to the right microsiemens. And this is a short-term fix. Soil drenches are a short-term fix. They're not a long-term fix. They're a short-term fix, okay? You can buy the refractometer I showed you the other day, and you can determine that. You can do that. You can do determine foliar sprays with that. What you can do is go out there and brix your leaf sap, and if it's low, you can do a foliar spray to bring that leaf sap up, okay? You can do that in the growing season. You don't have to do it months before, and you do that because you want to increase the brix in your plant, and when you increase the brix in your plant, you're going to increase the brix in your fruit, and plus, it acts as an insect deterrent, because insects don't like to eat high brix food, and they don't like to eat high brix leaves, okay? They'll move some other where. It's high brix leaves are death to an insect. They don't have the capacity to digest those long sugar chains. Okay, so that's how a refractometer helps, and anybody can buy a refractometer and use it in the field. And then with your dry blends, you want to do a soil test. That's a tool. The soil test, yes, the $70 soil test. But at least do the county or the university soil test for, I don't know, sometimes they're like $5 or $6. But do the soil test. Now, if you're doing organically, you want to do that in the fall. So you can put your recommendations on in the fall, because your recommendations are going to be organic. And it's going to take longer for them to work into the crop, so they'll be available for the plant. Don't expect to put on organic dry blends in the spring and the plant to benefit from them. They don't have long enough to break down. So you got to do all this in the fall before you plant. Okay, and give it 6 months to work in. So that's a long-term soil balancing tool to use, your soil test. And that's the end of that. And now, somebody at the Acres Conference said, after all the math and all the fractions and all the division and all the elements, I know you guys are like going, oh man, I came to the wrong class. Just skip this one. But don't worry, hang in there, because this is not rocket science. It's not rocket. I mean, you know, Gordon's a trained geologist. He knows this is simple stuff. It's a lot more complicated than that. Well, the reason, and that was, you know, it got a laugh at the seminar I was at, and I just had to add that. But the reason is, this is Kerry Reams up in the top right-hand corner. And the reason, he was an Adventist, a defrocked Adventist, but an Adventist nonetheless. And he was brilliant. I mean, he was out there. He had ways of defining things that science didn't have yet. And he, you know, supposedly he knew Albert Einstein, and they talked. I just thought this was funny. Albert Einstein is, you know, very famous for inventing how to break an atom apart or take apart matter and get energy. And Kerry Reams devoted his life to how to take energy and put it back into matter. And it's funny how a mushroom, or I didn't want to use a mushroom because sometimes people don't, it's not a good thing to talk about mushrooms, but even this tree looks like, you know, one's putting matter together and one's taking matter apart, and they kind of look similar. Anyway, we won't read all that. But anyways, the thing is with soil tests is, the reason I promote soil tests is, you know, we need to do this. Ellen White said, bring science into this work. You're really not bringing science into the work if you're just out there throwing on, doing what, you know, what your granddaddy did before you or anything like that. You got to bring science back into this work. And when you feel something wrong with your body, you go get a diagnostic test with your body when you feel something wrong. Same thing. Go get a diagnostic test on the soil, okay? And the soil health gives you the plant health, and the plant health gives you the body health, the human health. Anyways, and these are some of the tools. If you don't have a soil probe, which is this over here, you can just use a garden trowel. But the thing is, when you use these things, follow your lab's recommendations, because all their calibrations are set for a certain soil depth. So make sure you get an equal slice of soil for 6 inches or 5 inches or 8 inches or whatever they want, and they all want something different because their machines are calibrated for that depth. And you know they always tell you the test, the results are only as good as the sample you send in. So give them a good soil sample that it follows their, you know, protocol exactly, and then you'll get an accurate test and you'll get an accurate picture of what's in your soil. This is what they call the perfect soil. Very simple pie chart. It's 45% rock, geological rock that's been broken down. Okay, it's not all wood chips. You can't grow in all wood chips. You can't grow in all compost. Okay, it looks good. I give you that. I mean, it looks like good, rich stuff if you just try to grow in all compost. But it's not problems. It's not the perfect soil. The perfect soil is 25% rock and only 5% organic matter. And you're going to hear this term used differently. Some people use organic matter and they mean humus. Some people say organic matter and they just mean sort of in between mulch and humus. Okay? So, but this 5% is talking about fine particle humus, really broken down fine stuff, not sort of chunk up stuff that's broken down, but really fine stuff that's like coffee grounds. 5% organic matter. Remember, 5%, that 5% is going to hold a lot more nutrients than these minerals. The colloid, you know, the mineral colloid will hold, that's what the CEC is, but a little colloid of humus, a little colloid, will hold like 10 times, hundreds times more nutrients than a mineral colloid of clay or a mineral. Okay, and then your biology is going to let you have, your biology is going to open up and give you the porosity so you can have 25% air and 25% water. And that's the perfect growing soil. Oop. Okay, now when I say inorganic, I'm not talking like, you know, inorganic's bad and organic's good. I'm talking about no carbon. These are minerals. This is rock, okay? And that's 45% of your soil, your perfect soil. And remember, sand is, you know, here's the size, it's millimeters, but sand is like a big boulder, silt is a lot smaller, and clay is even smaller still, and a colloid is less than 0.00 millimeters. So a colloid is like that, and it's even smaller than a piece of clay, okay? But that right there is where the most nutrients are. Okay, sand doesn't hold a lot of nutrients, silt holds a little more, clay holds a little more, but that right there, that's the holy grail of nutrient holding in the mineral side, okay? Now, that's one half of the soil profile. The other half of the soil profile, is the organic stuff. So see, soils are very simple. They're either inorganic stuff or they're organic stuff. They're either stuff that was never living, it's just bits of rock, some sort of rock, or they're stuff that once was living is now dead, in the soil mixed in with that rock. So that's it. I mean, that makes it a lot simpler. And you have the same thing with the sizes. When it's up here, it's called mulch. You can easily distinguish that. This is leaf mulch. We see that you know, nothing's been broken down. It's a dead leaf. It still hasn't been broken down. It's mulch. It's big. Next, you have this sort of forest floor litter. It's kind of in between. It's organic matter or it's litter. Okay, it's kind of started to break down, but not all the way. Okay, you don't want to put that in your garden, really. If you add any of this stuff, you want to have it like this. You want to have it broken down. Now sometimes, you know, you can in the fall you can till in your residue and you can till this in, and because you're given it 6 months, by 6 months later it'll turn into this, hopefully, and then you plant. But you don't want to put this on and then plant into that, okay? You want to give it time to turn into this, or either turn it into this outside of the garden and then put this in the garden and then plant. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. And also, here, they have the tiny little dot, and that's the Holy Grail on the organic side, that micro-size humus, okay? And like I was telling you before, those colloidal, and you know, when I say a colloid, I mean it's so, wow, okay. I mean it's so small that it'll float, it'll stay suspended in water for, I don't know, a certain amount of time. It'll eventually maybe settle out, but it's so small it'll stay suspended in water. That's a colloid. That's how small it is. It normally would sink, but it floats. And you know that when it rains hard, the little particles float off first. So that's why you don't want a cover crop, so that doesn't happen. And that's why when the wind blows, or when you try not to, you know, to till on a really dry day, because the wind will just blow those colloids right out. Okay, and when you see that big dust cloud blowing off your field, that's the best part of your soil leaving. Okay, because that's where all the nutrient holding capacities. So try to time your tilling, and all these little things make you a good farmer, a good gardener. Okay, if you pay attention to all the little things. Soil structure. There's three components. This I kind of made this up myself. You've heard of the fire triangle. This is like the soil management triangle. And it's really got a lot of science. It's chemistry. And chemistry is, you know, what we're, you know, the periodic table and all the elements in the periodic table and how those compounds are made. And Albrecht, read books by Albrecht. My book reading list over there has a couple of Albrecht books. Read books by Albrecht. He's all into the chemistry. And he'll say chemistry, if you get the chemistry right, you'll have perfect soil. Then there's other books over there that have the Reams philosophy. And he's all about the energy, the way ions go between compounds and break apart and get back together. Read the books that are from the Kerry Reams disciples. Okay, he's all about energy, and we can call that physics. And then you have your Elaine Ingham books, like Teeming with Microbes, that you can get from the ABC. Glenn Paul knows about it. They're sold out. The Teeming of Microbes is Elaine Ingham, and she's still living, so you can talk to the woman herself there. And she says, if you get the microbiology right, everything will be right. So all these guys say that their leg of the triangle gives you the perfect soil. But, you know, it really it's kind of a mesh of them all three, you know. And so you're going to have, so don't just focus on one. Try to read all these guys, and these are all sort of alternative farmers, and try to read all these guys and bring the good stuff of all of them and decide for yourselves what you're going to keep and what you're going to leave, okay? And then when you understand this and you can get these legs right, and or at least deal with them intelligently, then you can control your tillage, you know, when you till, don't till when it's too wet, stuff like that. And when you get what you do here right and what you know here right, then things that you can't control, like rain and how much sunlight and the wind, the barometric pressure, they don't affect you as much. It's not that they don't affect you at all, but whereas one, you know, your crops might last a 28-degree frost night, where another guy's crops won't. I mean, a heavy, highly mineralized plant can withstand a lot colder temperatures. So you won't lose your crop on the first or second frost, but some other people will. So some of these nature effects that you can't control become less, you know, they bother you less, okay? Weed pressures become less. Weeds don't like to grow in fertile soil. Weeds like to grow in bad soil, most weeds. There's the green giant guy. Yeah, there we go. I was looking for you earlier. Luther, right? Luther? Paul. Paul. It wasn't Luther, it was Paul. Okay. Man-made pressures, if you can, and you say, well, how's a man-made pressure? How can this affect man-made pressures? I tell you, if you have a highly successful organic farm, people keep it there. You won't lose it to urban sprawl. And that's a man-made pressure, urban sprawl. When people come in and want to develop, a community will want to save its organic farm. It's the community's food security. Communities come to love their source of organic produce. And that's how you can help prevent man-made pressure. If you get all this right and you're doing good. Now, if you're a struggling organic farmer, hey, they might say, hey, we'd be better with a shopping mall here. You know. But if you're a good organic farmer and you're locked in with a community, they say, hey, skip the shopping mall. We want to keep our organic farm. It's doing good. All right, let's keep going. Okay, interview your labs. Okay, these are the labs I recommend. Now, there's other labs that kind of try to bridge. These guys are kind of purists. These are the Reams guys, International Ag Labs. It used to be run by Dan Scow, but he's getting on a bit. So John Frank is the man there now. He's the 30-something that's sort of taken over. And he's a really nice guy. He'll talk to you on the phone. These guys will talk to you on the phone too, and you'll talk to the guy who's actually doing the recommendations, and you can ask him, why are you recommending this? Neil Kinsey, he's out in Missouri. He follows the Albrecht method. Elaine Ingham, she has the company Soil Food Web, and she just got a new job. They hired her to go up to the Rodale Institute. That's pretty close. It's in Pennsylvania, right? Rodale Institute. It's very when it comes to organic farming, it's very prestigious. And she got to be asked to be, I think they're one of their research scientists at the Rodale Institute. So that was a real big honor. And so it must mean she's got something going on, because for the Rodale Institute to tap her. And before that, she had developed her own soil labs that, remember, they don't do elements. They could care less about the periodic table. They count microbes. And they say the microbes will release, 5 minutes, and then they say microbes will release those things. And then this morning I was on the phone with your local county extension agent, but he's a state extension agent, so he's the whole state of West Virginia, West Virginia University state agent, and this is his number. His name is Tom Bazin. He was trained conventionally, but he was very open to organic procedures, and he knew a lot about it. And he told me, remember, I meant to bring that up when I started off here, he told me I was really worried about, we were too far north to do a winter cover crop. Like, you could never get it in. But he assured me you could get a winter cover crop in. And he said the best time to plant it in these parts was you had to get in by September 20th latest. So you had to, you know, sometime between September 1st and September 20th. But if you're trying to, you know, eke out the last bit of your summer tomatoes before you take them down, September 20th was the absolute latest to do your cover crop. And he recommended cereal rye, not the annual rye, but the cereal rye, and because it comes up in colder temperatures, it germinates in colder temperatures better, and Clemson clover, he said, does really well around here. So do a mix of cereal rye and Clemson clover, and that's what this guy told me this morning. So I was on the phone. I talked to your local West Virginia County Extension agent, and there are loads of help telling about frost dates and things like that. Huh? Okay. So anyways, just, you know, remember what Henry Ford said? He goes, you can ask me any question, give me an hour and I'll have you an answer. I might not know everything, but I'll you know, with the internet now and the communications, you can find out anything you want to know in about an hour. And Henry Ford said that back in the early 1900s. Different tests, we won't really get into this, but this is why you get different numbers. The same soil will give different numbers from different labs. There's no acid test, there's weak acid test, and there's strong acid test. And all these labs have their own philosophy on what test to use. So just interview the labs and figure out which one makes sense to you. I do use International Ag Labs, but I'm not trying to force them on anyone. You can use an Albrecht, people are happy with them. You can use Elaine Ingham, people are happy with them. Okay, we won't even get into this. Reams Labs, they focus on energy release per grams of soil, which is this right here, and they focus on the conductivity meter. We won't get into the rest of that. Albrecht Labs use the strong acid test. They focus on cation exchange capacity and the base saturation on that colloid. They have a different definition of a cation anion, more traditional definition of a cation anion than Reams does. And here is, okay, this is what I was trying to get to. This kind of gives you the root and how this mineral exchange happens in the Albrecht model. Okay? This, and you can see you have humus particles, which are loaded up a lot more. That's why humus is good with these cations, magnesium, calcium, they're a double cation. You got potassium, and then you got some hydrogen, and there's some ammonia, nitrogen, and you got magnesium. And then you got your clay particles with the same thing. And what the plant does is it tries to exchange some of its hydrogen, and hopefully the particle will give it some magnesium. And it goes through the cell in an osmosis process, okay? So you're trying to, you know, that's the exchange that has to happen. And the more these things are in these percentages around this particle, the better your soil is and the more fertile it is. Potential high, pH is just stand, pH is a myth, you know, like all you have to worry about is getting the pH right. That's a myth. Okay, just like in our health message, pH is a symptom, it's not a cause. What causes pH, you know, the old adage is, if you're low on pH, you lime up. If you're high in pH, you're alkaline, you acid it down with sulfur. Okay? That's like everybody, every typical farmer does that, but that's not the problem. The new adage is you balance all those cations and the pH will take care of itself. You got to have the right balance around that colloid of those cations and you'll have perfect pH. Okay? pH, don't worry about the pH. Worry about the balance of the cations around the colloid. We all know about high pH and low, below 7 and above 7 is, you know, how you determine something's alkaline or acid. And basically, when it's alkaline, it's hungry for hydrogen. If it's acid, it's throwing off hydrogen. So if you have an acid soil, it's throwing off a lot of hydrogen. If it's an alkaline soil, it's hungry. It's wanting to drink in a lot of hydrogen. Calcium, magnesium, and potassium, and sodium can all raise your pH. Hello? Okay. Not just calcium. So any of those can raise your pH. Why does pH matter? Well, this is why they get worked up about pH. It's because when you get a very high pH or a very low pH, a lot of these macronutrients and some of these micronutrients start becoming either highly available, which you don't want, like aluminum. It's not on here, but aluminum, if you get acid soil, aluminum becomes highly available, and you get toxic results from that. But, you know, if you get a strongly acid pH, you lose your ability to metabolize, the plant loses its ability to metabolize nitrogen, or a strong alkaline, same thing. So this is how the pH is, and here they are at the bottom of this chart. And this is a standard chart, affects your nutrient availability, and that's why everybody worries about pH. But pH is, like I said, is not the problem. If you've got high pH, you might have high potassium and low calcium. Well, you want to add calcium. You don't want to add sulfur. You just want to add calcium and get rid of potassium. You don't want to add sulfur. That's not going to help you with your problem. First focus on the amounts and then focus on the ratios. There's certain ratios, but you have to have the amounts before you have to worry about the ratios. So you want a 7-to-1 calcium magnesium and 1-to-1 phosphorus and potassium. And then on and on and on. We can go over that later. Okay. And then you have the Elaine Ingham lab. We already talked about her with the biology. These are examples of soil lab tests. This is an Albrecht lab. This is Neil Kinsey's lab. One of my friends does that, and I photocopied it. Then you have, this is my lab, and I think I gave you a copy of that yesterday, International Ag Labs. That's, you can see right there the ergs. I had a 280. It's 200. You want to keep it around 400 or 500 when you're growing. That's that. And then here's the recommendations. I think I gave you a copy of that yesterday. And see these numbers out here? I just added those. This is for 1,000 square feet. So I had to turn that into 352 square feet, and that's how I did it. When it's 1,000, you can just multiply, 0.352, and you'll get what you need. And that's that. And this is the Elaine Ingham Soil Food Web Lab report. And you can see she's counting active bacteria, total bacteria, active fungi, total fungi. That's what she counts. She doesn't count calcium and phosphorus and all that. So you can see there's different ideas about how to do a proper soil test and give you an indication of the what your soil needs. Now this is in my neck of the woods in Georgia. This is the typical extension report, county extension report. And you can see really there is no such thing as, they give you a line here and they give you a few elements. And they just tell you, if you're below the line, you need some, and if you're above the line, you don't need any. They never tell you if you've got too much. They just tell you, oh yeah, you're good. But they don't tell you, you're way over, and you're bad. That's bad. So that's how, they got some catching up to do. Okay, this is real quick, and I'm almost finished here. The calcium to mag. These are my garden soil tests lined up year to year to year. And what I wanted to point out with this is, see right here, I was low. I wanted 3,000 pounds of calcium. I only had 1,833 pounds of calcium. Okay, but look at my pH. Where is it? Right here. It was 7.6, which is really high. Okay, it was 7.6. Well, every year, and you can hear it, here was 7.5. Here it was 7.4. Now, finally, in 2011, it's 7.0. But every year, I'm adding calcium. My calcium numbers are not really going up. They're kind of stable because... And I'm not trying to really raise them right now. I'm just trying to keep them from sinking but every year I'm adding calcium, but my pH is going down. Most people will tell you that's impossible. You know, if you got high pH, don't put any calcium on. But you can see I added at least 500 pounds an acre of calcium every year here, and my pH still came down. The reason my pH was so high is, look at my potassium. I'd put on a lot of organic matter and a lot of manure. Look at my potassium. Desired is 167 pounds per acre. I had 493. I'm way over in potassium because of all the organic, all the manure and compost I put on. But slowly, by not adding any, I came down 305. I don't know what happened here. I shot up. I swear I didn't put any on, you know. but here I'm back down in 283, and that's getting pretty close. I mean, I'm trending to the right direction, you know. And that's what you want to do. You'll line these things up. And that's why when you do a soil test, do it at the same time every year. I always tell people, do it in the first half of August. That's when your soils look the worst. Do it at the same time every year. Use the same lab for three times in a row. Don't chop and change, because they all do things differently. And depending on what month of the year it is, the soils will look different every month of the year. So you want to do it the same time every year and use the same lab for at least 3 years in a row. But keep on doing it every year at the same time. Okay, field tests. I mean, these are just obvious things. Is your plant happy? Is it droopy? Now, if you have a midday, if you have a noon wilt, well, that's normal. Don't worry about a noon wilt. But if it's still wilted at sunset, it should be perked back up at sunset. It needs water. Okay. Is the plant standing straight, or is it, you know, bending all over the place? You know, that's not a happy plant. You want straight plants. You want thick trunks, and you want thick leaves. Okay. Does the plant pull? Okay, if you go to pull the plant out of the ground, does it want to come out of the ground? If it really comes out of the ground easy, it's not a happy plant. If it's, you know, tough to get out of the ground, it likes it. That's a good indication you're doing something right. These are for people who are allergic to cinnamon. They think labs are a waste of money. You know, okay, if you think that, at least do these things. What's the overall color of the plant? You want something that's just a normal kind of green. You don't want a deep, rich blue green. You don't want a light green. You want a kind of a normal, rich, lush green. Do leaves have a healthy gloss? Normally, leaves will have a gloss to them. If they look kind of velvety and velvety, then maybe that's not a good sign of health. You want a thick leaf and not a thin, not a big leaf that's thin. You don't care. You want a small leaf, but you want thickness in that leaf. That's a healthy leaf. Not so much size, but thickness. Does the earth around the plant, does it smell fresh, or is there a peculiar odor, methane maybe? You've dug your organic matter too deep, it's rotting under there, it's producing methane gases. Are the birds singing? Are there birds at all? Happy birds are a sign of a healthy environment. What type of weeds are there? And here's a cool thing. You can measure, I had a buckwheat come up in my pole beans, and I'm telling you, when you get to your soils right, my pole beans measured higher in Brix than my buckwheat, which buckwheat at this time was a weed because I really didn't want it growing there, but it came up and I let it grow. But the insects were leaving my beans alone and attacking my buckwheat. When the insects, you see insect damage on the weeds and not your cash crop, you're doing something right. Because the insects are going to go after the lowest sugar thing. Okay? So you want healthy plants and non-healthy weeds, you're doing something right. Another field test I think I told about, right there is the ponds. When you slice that longwise, you can see this discoloration. That's not a good sign. It should be pearly white like this, not dark like this. And if you slice it crosswise, there shouldn't be any dark rings in there. It should just be pearly white, okay? You got something going on, you need to photograph it and send the photograph to your extension agent and say, hey, what's going on here? And at least, you know, identify what's wrong. And he can help you identify that. He's trained to do that. Of course, we already talked about these refractometers. That's it. And the last thing I want to say is, after this, I'm going to go out there and build a little sample of a drip line for irrigation. I want to talk about irrigation next. And anybody who wants to meet me out there, it'll only take about 15 minutes. You can help me build it. It'll be really fast. And I'm going to do that right after this talk, right before dinner. And the other thing is, tomorrow I would like to, after sometime either before dinner or after dinner, before the 7 o'clock, I would like to stand out in my truck, not use the thing in here, but stand out in my truck and do a tools demo. I brought all these tools to show you and do a tools demonstration after the meeting, if that's okay. And you guys tell me if you want to do it before or after dinner. But you know, we'll It won't get into the 7 o'clock thing. We'll be done by then. But just tell me what time before or after dinner. So I have about 30 minutes to show you some of those tools out there.